You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Keith Donahue is the author of The Stolen Child, Angels of Destruction, Centuries of June, The Boy Who Drew Monsters, The Motion of Puppets, and coming in August 2024, The Girl in the Bog. His work has been translated into 24 languages. He also reviews books and wrote speeches for the chairman of the National Endowment of the Arts. He lives in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. Today, we'll be talking about his novel, The Boy Who Drew Monsters. Thank you for joining me, Keith.
Hey, great to be here, Rick. Good to see you.
Now, this is a really interesting and I think in many ways an absolute exemplar of what a classic, great, I would say probably described as a horror genre novel would be, but I think it punches well above its weight there. It's a great literary novel. I mean, in the same genre as The Turn of the Screw. And that's, I think, maybe its closest amalgam. But you do a lot more with this. One of the things that struck me about this book is that the main character is autistic, and we have a whole range of characters who are really well psychologically described, and even though there are some supernatural elements in this, it's a very intensely psychological novel. When you began writing it, did you design the psychology of the characters into the plot of the novel?
Well, right. So they're interconnected, definitely. The idea stemmed from a short film I saw about parents of a autistic child who is becoming too difficult to raise on their own. And I wanted to write a gothic novel. I wanted to write a psychological novel, and I had my subject after seeing that film. So yes, to the long answer is yes. For me, it was primarily not a horror novel at all, but a psychological novel. In fact, the original title was called The Inside Boy.
That makes sense. And also that speaks to the very careful character design and setup. This is a very small cast in this novel. And it's, a few spaces. It's almost a play in a sense of a novel. And so talk about confining your cast and creating your cast so that you can get the plot moving. And one of the things that I found interesting is there are no, really heroic or super great characters in this book. These are, the kind of people you might meet, might be friends with and think, well, gosh, they have their problems all knocked out for you.
Right. Right. We all have our problems, right? And I think some that put some readers off sometimes, but I wanted to be as truthful as I could to the central concern of the book. And it's interesting that you said a play after the first images and conception of what this next story is going to be about come to me in some mysterious way, I started thinking about structure, and you're dead on. It's structured like a play, a 5-act play. It's in 5 parts, and there's different scenes from different points of view. And the characters kind of work their way, how to put this, into my subconsciousness, where they're I'm trying to set up a situation, right, where each character's got some problem. And in almost every case, they try to solve it the wrong way, or they come from it from the wrong, well, I don't know, right and wrong, but they come from a scarred perspective, that when I talk to readers about this book, and some honestly have this sort of visceral reaction as if I'm the monster. But I couldn't be more empathetic to all of them, and to try to understand all of their different points of view, however flawed, and working their way through, one of the more difficult problems of love, right? Where you have to learn how to be a good parent, or to be a good friend, or to be a good son, et cetera. So, yeah.
I think that, the core family, Jack, Peter, and his mother and father are all so well done. And one of the things I first noticed was, the father who, he makes the decision early on in their marriage and once they understand their child to stay home. And the mother is going to, who's already has some traction as a lawyer, is being seen to make, the decision that she'll be able to make money. So talk about a little bit about just the economics of these characters. It's very lightly handled, but it also plays a very critical role in creating the tenor of their everyday lives.
Right. Well, so the father in the story does not realize the extent of, his son's withdrawal, and the son, yeah, you mentioned he's autistic, or he's on the spectrum, or whatever, however you would want to call that, but he's also got other issues. He's agoraphobic, and he's obsessive, and different things like that. All, and in part because, as I say, people look at other people who have, Down syndrome or autism, or as, somehow different in their emotional or internal emotional lives. Just because they're not expressed in the same way that other people express them, but they have them, and that was my primary empathy. So I set up the situation where the father would be at home, because the father is not, he thinks his son is going to get, quote, better somehow, or that his son, that everything will work itself out. And the tension with the mother, who is realizing that her son's getting older, and if he's physically maturing, and he's, he accidentally lashed out at her and hurt her, and so now she's got this problem as well. So it's the sort of dynamic of that family where, I'm not sure that I thought through as much as your question implies the economics of it, but I wanted the dad to stay at home. And I wanted the mother to be able to leave the house, for the purposes of the drama, if you will, of the.
I really liked the mother figure, but all the characters, and despite the fact that they're not, filled with really somewhat likable traits or aren't making great decisions, nonetheless, I really love them all because they're all making realistic decisions that are hard and difficult and have. Don't have the best consequences, but sometimes that is the hand you are dealt, and you have to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. And I think that Holly, who, unlike her husband Tim, the father, Tim wants to believe that Jack Peter's going to be okay. And from what we can see, that is a faint and fading hope.
Right.
Holly, on the other hand, doesn't think that, but you tend to think that, there's something between the two poles that each of the parents have that would be, the most helpful for them and the most helpful for their son, but they don't quite reach that. But I really love Holly. Talk about creating this really interesting woman who's very dynamic and understandably concerned for herself in the face of an attack by her son, who all of a sudden, it's a second from, it's 1 second,
Yeah.
1 second from being your cute and cuddly kid to being a menace who could really hurt you.
Yeah, and I have to confess I was drawn from this film that I mentioned. I wish I saw it years before writing The Boy Who Drew Monsters, but this film where, the mother had to grab a broom to protect herself. And her son was not usually like that, and something there was a trigger. In the case of the book, it's a nightmare, and so my feeling, and I have to also say that from my own life, right, that I like everybody, I've known parents who have had to make these difficult decisions about their own children, about whether they can appropriately care for the child. And then, of course, older parents who have, children that need care. And as a father or a parent, you worry about that. You worry about even what's going to happen to my child after I'm not here, even though that's kind of a unanswerable question, in some respects. So yeah, my feeling with Holly was she loves her son deeply. She is afraid of, the situation, not her son, but of the situation that she's in. And, at the same time, in the action of the book and the action of the narrative, she starts confronting primarily sounds, but sounds from the outside that are reaching into her, and she doesn't know what's happening to her, and what these sounds mean. They scare her. And so she's, they both parents are kind of wrapped up in that story of agoraphobia, where the house becomes, a setting for the psychological swirl around them. Part of it is, you can read it either way. You could read it as, this is a symbol, or this is really happening.
Well, this speaks to one of the things I think this book does really, really well, which is to use elements of the of blur psychology, the elements of psychology, and the elements of the fantastic things that, we just can't explain happening, and use them to externalize the unresolvable conflicts that the couple finds themselves in. I mean, they are in a house that's somewhat isolated with a child who will not leave the house and who is suffering from, a kind of unknowable mental malady. And everybody within the house starts to externalize the things they fear. And those things, obviously, are seen in the environment around them. And it really doesn't matter whether they're real or not. They are real enough to the characters,
right,
to cause the characters to change their emotions and change their evaluation of the situation they came in. And I think this is a very difficult card to play in the literary world, and you know, it's been done superbly a few times. The Turn of the Screw does it, and I think The Boy Who Drew Monsters does it as well. So talk about, you know, the conflict you experience as a writer. You know, it's, the book's called The Boy Who Drew Monsters, so you know,
right,
you
gives away the plot.
you that right there, you're telling the readers that there's going to be monsters in this book, but you want them to seem realistic but not realistic. That's a must for you as a writer. Is that a hard battle to be fought within you?
Well, that's a good question. It's more, I'm not sure I would express it the same way. I think it's more of an interesting challenge to set yourself to say, okay, well, there's this young boy who drew monsters and they seem to be coming to life in the world outside of his house. And as a matter of fact, they seem to want to come into his house. Are they real? Are they figments of his imagination? Is everybody crazy here? Where the parents start thinking, I'm seeing these things too. You know, and it's part of that contract with the reader where, you know, I hope to make it clear from the outset that I'm not trying to, you know, it's not like I'm trying to run a trick here or a scam where these are, oh, they're not really there, or, oh yeah, they're really there. I want you to decide in part how would you think of them. For me, they're vivid enough to move through the landscape or to, you know, bang on the door or what have you. They're real enough in my mind, which, you know, is its own universe. But it's more of it was kind of the reason to write the book this way was to, for the challenge of it, the sort of, you know, I'd admired Gothic stories for a long time. Had never tried to, you know, write one in that same structure. And, you know, I'm glad you think there's a balance there. I'm glad you think that effect has been achieved, because it was the main effect. It was the main sort of theme to the song that I was trying to get across.
You know, one of the things I loved about this book was early on, Tim, the father, sees one of the monsters, and the way it's described is just masterful, absolutely perfect. In terms of, you know, I think of H.P. Lovecraft's great contribution is to show us some horrifying thing and then say, that's the monster's toenail.
Yeah.
And on the other side of the equation, M.R. James did a fabulous job of just like describing kind of hints and shadows and you know, curtains that look kind of oddly folded and scaring the bejeebers out of you. And that's one of the things that this book is authentically frightening. And, you know, you're just frightened for what you might see in this world, because your eyes can go anywhere and anything can go into your eyes. And even more so now that we live in a world of deep fakes. But I think what I'm getting at is the initial description of the monster was really well done and perfect. Leaving it to the imagination of the reader, and the reader's imagination in this book just goes crazy. I mean,
right. Well, that's great. You know, So in every novel, right, the getting the suspense stretched out over the length of the narrative, right, the five acts or whatever, is part of the challenge that you know, and part of the fun and inventiveness of writing ever is, okay, well, what next? You know, and not that you have to deliberately try to top, you know, scare for scare or something like that, but sort of the variety of experiences of what Jack Peter is drawing, or the things that he draws that come to life. So let's put it that way. Were the, you know, the, in some weird paradoxical way, that the funnest, the most fun, parts of the book to write is, you know, there's a scene where, you know, there are babies in one scene, outside the house. And those were, you know, and in a way, I don't like creeping myself out, but it happens.
That was an amazing scene.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, I one of the things I think that is this book does really good at, well, is that it feels full. This is a novel, no full stop. And you give us really very vivid characters, and also we have neighbors, and the neighbor's son Nick is Jack Peter's only friend. And the neighbor couple, that they've always been nice to these people who moved in, but we it feels like a full novel, but it moves like lightning. It's very fast to read, but not, I think, too fast. Some novels, you know, it's just like an endless chase scene. You say, well,
Right.
it's to me, some novels might elicit a reaction to me that I have when watching sports, which is, I'll just wait. Why would I bother to watch the match? I can just read the headline
Yeah, right.
afterwards. And you can get that way with novels that are too tensely plotted. But this novel, it offers all the joys of like discovering the characters, the houses, the places they live.
Yeah.
Well, did you have to strip a lot of words out of this?
No, I actually had to add something after the sort of, I don't want to call it a first draft because that's not the case, but before a submission to my publisher, I had to add, you know, the folklore, the Japanese folk monster folklore into the text. So that was not there. So if you can imagine it zipping by, because I think that that addition enriches the book. You know, the and that character and her, how she mirrors Jack Peter in certain ways, you know, adds depth to the characters. And it's always the problem, right? It's always the character driven, plot driven, both. You know, having the structure of the five act play, knowing that these scenes were set up for a perspective shift, you know, this character, we're going to look through that character's perspective, helped slow it down in a way, because now we have to get into that mind. And that mind's very different from, you know, Holly or Tim. Nick is, you know, this really interesting friend who, you know, the sort of the mandatory friend. You know, he's the only one who'll play with Jack Peter, and he feels trapped. And of course, there's a precipitating event that adds to all that, where the boys were swept up by a wave in the ocean and years earlier. So they have got this. What's the zodiac sign? The twin,
Pisces.
Pisces. They've got this Pisces relationship going on where they're, you know, the yin and yang of one boy, or the codependency taken to the extreme.
You know, one of the big aspects of this book is the setting, the Eastern Seacoast town. And, you know, when it sits in and there's going to be like, you know, snow and nor'easter, and it's got, and we learn also about Iraq, I couldn't help but think of, you know, one of my favorite John Carpenter movies, The Fog, which has a similar setting. I think it's actually West Coast, but, you know, the idea of the small seacoast town that harbors a secret wreck outside of it. And I'd like you to talk about, you know, discovering that and you know, using those ideas. One of the things I really love is that mixture of different kinds of the fantastic, because on one hand, you know, it's understandable that the boy who draws these things maybe so intensely, he's autistic, so he's very, very intensely into everything he's into. That kind of coming to life is one aspect of the fantastic. Ghosts are another, and I think that, you know, on one hand, you could play them off of one another, but the way you do it is to just mingle it and say, you know, our perception of reality is a continuum, and that one of the things this book does very well is to break down the reader's sense that we all partake of the same reality.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So there is a shipwreck. Well, to sidetrack slightly here. Maine, winter, seaside, snowstorm, gothic. But my wife actually turned me on to this setting because she said she saw an article about cross-country skiing at the beach, you know, and I thought, okay, now I've got the setting for my next novel, the beach in winter. I hadn't really thought about that. So yeah, the different sets of reality. So yeah, there's a shipwreck, and I believe I wrote this book some time ago, but I believe at least the idea of a list of survivors is in. There's a genuine list and a genuine archives about such a wreck. There could be ghosts. There could be ghosts coming. I mean, it really does depend on your perspective. You were talking earlier about the curtain blowing in the window and, you know, convincing you that your days are numbered. It's just a curtain. It is at its heart about how we perceive, what we believe, and the things we believe that we can't see or can't empirically prove are just as much a part of our daily lives as, you know, the things we can not quote on.
One of the things I think that works really well is the way you draw the friendship between the boys, you know, the power balance, and also what Nick, who's relatively normal, the accommodations he makes to be with his friend who is not in any way normal. And I think, you know, this speaks to a larger, more important part, you know, perception of friendship is that friendship is working with what you've got.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Poor Nick. He doesn't have a good family life of his own. His parents have issues. He is more or less, you know, I don't know, force is the right word, but he feels compelled to hang out with Jack Peter, and you know, and they, you know, the things that were the most vivid to me were, I'm not sure it survived into the novel or not, but there was a scene where they're playing war on the bed, and they've got their little toy soldiers, and I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, they were plastic, and you could have soldiers or knights or some other characters, and you just mixed and matched, and your army was the green army, and that your friends was the blue. But yeah, that idea is of friendship, and as you say, what you get what you get. You know, you get the friends. I don't know if you get the friends you deserve, but you get the friends that are there, that are just almost like siblings, that in so many ways can be different from one another. And yet there's some essential bond. There's some, and part of it is having that shared experience, but I think there's something deeper. So I was playing around with that with Nick and Jack, that they, yeah, they're extremely different, but in ways they're not. In ways that they respond to the monsters in the world, they're you know, in that, I don't want to give away anything. Well, maybe I do. But in one of the climactic parts of the book, where Jack Peter has to face his agoraphobia, you know, Nick is there. Nick is by his side. Nick is there to help. And that's what friends are for, you know, to help you face your monsters.
You know, I hadn't realized how, until you mentioned it, how touching and powerful that scene is, because it's done, so it's very natural. And that's one of the things I think that's really important in a book that incorporates aspects of the fantastic, which is to make sure that everybody has very reasonable responses. And I have to, oh my God, what a great two characters, the priest and his Japanese woman sidekick. I mean, they are wonderful, wonderful characters. And the whole thing, the whole novel feels very, I guess, homey and familiar in a really good, solid way. And I think that's an interesting aspect of just reading this book. You know, I just felt like, okay, I've kind of been here before, but I've never been here before. And this is exciting and thrilling. And it really felt like, you know, a nice, a home night. And so talk about the idea of just creating, you know, two homes, or three, really, if you include the church, that feel real and powerful and supportive of the frail lives of the humans within.
Right, so you have a priest, a Catholic priest, and his housekeeper, which, you know, I know from hard experience. I've met many priests and many housekeepers, and of course they've been characterized on in movies and other books and so on. And you know, there's always some element. There's always some, you know, I wouldn't call it sexual exactly, but there's always some gender element that's involved there, that they're, you know, like an old married couple in some ways. And where in this case, she is more, she's very concerned about his well-being in the world. And she also knows things that he doesn't know and would never know. And she's, you know, secretly the smarter of the two. So those were fun to write, and you know, things that come to you in the process of, well, let's have a cake. That comes from some weird place that, you know, the babies crawling off the wall don't aren't as difficult to write as the cake. The Keenans, Holly and Tim's home. You know, it's at Christmas time as well, so that's another nod to the Gothic. And you know, the parts that I really remember are things like, you know, they're listening to records. You know, they're that old fashioned that they're listening to records on the record player. It's Christmas carols and you know, and they have their buried secrets and yet they're making the best of it. And they're in their home. There was a third place, but I don't remember what you were pointing to. Well, with the church scene, scene in the church. Yeah. Where, you know, again, and my empathy is with, which is actually the strange part of having readers, you know, and having readers say what they think, which is within their rights. But having readers who found who thought I was being, like, I don't know, needlessly cruel or something to Jack Peter, when in reality, you know, those little moments that are scattered throughout the book where he gets to assert himself and share his feelings, those were the most uplifting for me to write, at least, let me put it that way, where I got close to, we all have it rough, and this kid has it rough, really rough, but you know, you gotta love him.
One of the things about this book is that none of the characters are designed to be likable. You know, we don't feel like, okay, here's the hero, here's the bad right. guy. They're all just reasonable people. And as a result, once as readers, we figure this out, this is going to be, in a sense, more of a slice of life novel than most. You know, we really like them all and respect, you know, the decision you have made as a writer to not engage in that hero thing.
Yeah, I had an interesting term that came at me the other week about the reader's proxy, and you know, which characters in an ensemble novel, which character is the reader's proxy? None. Or all of them. You know, I hadn't thought of that question. I hadn't thought of sort of, well, who's a reader going to identify? I just thought the reader's going to peek through the window here and see this, you know, dysfunctional situation, and that becomes horrifying, and work your way through it, man. You know, you got to work your way through. There's not going to be a character that, you know, as you say, sort of is the good guy or the protagonist. It's more a case of how do they? I guess if anybody is the reader's proxy, maybe this is too difficult to accept, really. But it's the boy. You know, it's the boy is, you know, he's facing his fears in really deep ways.
This is a book that takes childhood fears seriously. And when you're a child, what you're afraid of, you take very seriously, more so than anything else, because, you know, you don't understand that, you know, there's this giant world that's turning around you, that's trying to crush you. You're just trying to get by with what the people around you think. And
Yeah.
this is a book that really takes those fears seriously, makes them real as they are to the children who experience them.
Yeah.
And talk about, you know, conflating the fears we have of, you know, being rejected by our parents, by our peers, by the kids at school, and, you know, those kind of monsters, and conflating those and kind of like, you know, rewrapping them as, you know, horrifying creatures of from the world of the fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I wanted readers to sort of ask the question of, you know, sort of the, let's call him the main monster. you know, how much like his father is he? You know, how much like Tim is this thing out in the snow? That, you know, am I being replaced by this, by a baby? Then what do I do with that? Well, I'll have them come and get you. Or I'm trying to think of more specific examples, but yeah, generally, right. So the boy is, the inside boy is stuck inside and he's looking out into the world and really not speaking this, but kind of wistfully at the very least. He sees twins across the road. He would like to have more friends. He would like to have any friends. He would like for his father to behave himself. You know, so he starts manifesting all those anxieties, fears, desires in his drawings. And of course, then, you know, by some stroke, they are visible to all of us, readers, and to some extent to the other characters in the novel. And the mother, as I said before, she starts hearing things first. The father's, as you said before, the, you know, the first encounter of, he's driving Nick back home in the night, and out pops this white thing. You know, is it a big white dog? Is it a guy with a beard? What is this? He doesn't know. We, hopefully, the viewers, the readers, know more than anybody. We know everybody's perspective, and hopefully we're piecing together the central story, which is about the boy's confrontation of his fears.
You know, one of the things I think you do extremely well is to, within this really confined narrative, I mean, there's not a lot, you don't have a lot of places to go. This is not, as a writer, I mean, you know, you can't all of a sudden say, okay, we're all going to sunny California. No, that's not going to happen. Nonetheless, I think you do a great job of having a number of kind of shock moments in the manuscript. And I think that for me, I would say I'm a monster hound. You know, I like John Carpenter's The Thing, mm-hmm. is, you know, the ne plus ultra of monster music, and there's everything in it. And so I like that kind of monster movie, but I also like something that's subtle and underhand, and, you know, underbaked, as it were.
Yeah.
Like
or
this.
Underhanded.
but the kind of shocks you insert in the novel that you manage to find, they're really good. And, you know, it comes on two planes, the realistic plane and the unrealistic plane. And there's kind of like, you know, broken mirror shards. when you were architecting it, the novel, did you find yourself having to move different points of revelation around to match different aspects of the fantastic that you'd exhibited, or did this all just fall out kind of naturally as the rain on the ground?
Well, my method, right, is to put up the scaffolding and then start living in it. And you know, you're talking about you create problems for yourself, right, as a writer, where you're going to have a essentially what is a one set story. You know, it's about being in a house, and the book I wrote just prior to that was about being in a house, and I was, you know, influenced by the poetics of space in my thinking about how homes, in particular, are this great metaphor for growing up. You know, and people like Frost and others who go back to look at childhood, not because I find being a child any more interesting than being an adult. In certain ways, it's not. But there's I think in stories with a couple of stories that I've written that have younger children in them, there is that. It aids in convincing the reader that the fantastical can happen because they remember they were a child once themselves, and they believed in all kinds of things that they couldn't see, or, you know, they were the first ones to, you know, worry about the curtain or to look under the bed. That's the child. And even to this day, you know, the light isn't just right, you know, you're seeing things still. I keep, on the cool nights around here that we're having this spring, keep the window open, and then the window shines on the opposite wall, like Plato's cave. And I, you know, every once in a while, it startles me. It doesn't scare me, but it startles me. Am I looking at the window, or am I looking at the shadows on the other wall? And so that was a kind of world that I wanted to build for this story, where the fact that he can't leave actually helps me, because now anything that I'm going to invent, any monster that comes along the way, has some relationship to the house, that they're trapped in, to the mind, you know, that these thoughts are trapped in. And so it's not more difficult to write. It's not any more difficult to write. It's the same. It's as hard to write as that book as it was the one before it, which had, you know, 8 different stories over 8 different locations and across the country and all tied together. You know, you learn to live within the structure that you've created for the novel, or you give up. You give up writing that particular, or you change the structure. But fortunately for me, in this case, once I decided, it was pretty, you know, straight through with the structure.
Well, I don't want to give away anything. I will say the ending is amazingly superb. I mean, just really, and it seems like, you know, it'd be a difficult novel to end, and you do something that's really wonderful. Was that always baked in, or did that, like, come upon your coming to the final page of the book?
Well, I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but it was not planned per se. So I knew that, you have a vague notion of the climactic moment of the book, or at least I do. I'm stretching to that in the score. I'm stretching to that moment where here's the that occurs, of course, before the ending of the book, and then there's this denouement and the falling action. And that's the really the hardest part of the book, right? Because then you have to end. I mean, I suppose you could end, when the final conflict is immediately over, the end. But I wanted some redemption for these characters, and so again, without spoiling it, the last scene is set in a or the last section is set in be opens in a hospital emergency room, and Jack Peter, who is a basically resistant to every other human interaction, spies a girl across the room. They exchange smiles. There's his redemption. The rest of it, what you're talking about, came at some point after that. And then, of course, once I add the final turn of the screw, then I had to go back and, sew in some clues.
You have a book coming out in September, The Girl in the Bog. And I think from what I can discern, this continues your interest in kind of Irish storytelling. Could you talk a little bit about Irish fairy tales and Irish cultural lore, that kind of how that informs your work?
Yeah, right. Well, it's coming out in August, just so. So I didn't realize I was Irish. I didn't know that, or Irish American. I had no idea. Growing up is despite the name, despite the red hair, and but it, I wasn't steeped in the folklore or the mythology or anything like that as a kid. I was an American boy. So this came much later, and once I discovered, and I think primarily through the music of the language, was my first attraction to it. Of like, these people don't speak the same English as we do, or the English. How did that happen? So yeah, so a lot of the motifs and let's just call it sort of the acceptance of the other world, the just, the unquestioned acceptance of the other world. There's some other world than what we find ourselves in. It's not a peculiarly Irish thing, but they do it with a certain panache, that such things as banshees so I think if anything, it's that attitude of acceptance. Like a lot of people, I often hear, well, from friends of mine who say, and I wouldn't have picked this up. I wouldn't have, but I liked it. And it's sort of that distaff view of the winking view of life, and included among that is the whole dark side of life, that there's a optimistic fatalism so at play.
Keith Donahue is the author of The Boy Who Drew Monsters. His forthcoming book is The Girl in the Bog. Thank you for joining me, Keith.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.